Thanks for joining us on WPR News Today. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And in case you're thinking that music sounded familiar, well, we're going to be talking about the book Piracy on the Great Lakes, True Tales of Freshwater Pirates. And Michael Klassen is the author of the book and our guest today. Michael has been writing and photographing Northern Michigan for newspapers and magazines for 40 years, creating feature articles about the life and culture of Michigan's North Country. He's founder of the UP Reader and is a member of the board of directors for the Upper Peninsula Publishers and Authors Association. And in 2020, Michael won the Historical Society of Michigan's George Follow Award for Upper Peninsula History. What are your questions about pirates and the history of the Great Lakes? Well, I'd love to hear from you. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Michael, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here.
You bet. So I'm assuming you're with us from Upper Michigan. I hear you live in the Sioux.
I do. It's a wonderful place to be, and it's also just full of history on its own.
It certainly is. Now, how long have you been up in the UP?
Since about 1979.
Oh, so for quite a while.
Oh, yeah. And decided not to go home.
I'm sorry, you dropped out for that first part of your sentence there. You said...
I came up here to go to school at Northern Michigan University and decided never to go home. So.
I don't think you're alone in that, are you?
Oh, no, not a bit.
Now, Piracy on the Great Lakes is one of several books that you've written about the history in the UP. Why don't you kind of give us an overview of the history of the region?
Well, there's plenty, plenty of history like there is throughout most of our Great Lakes, going back to the days of the voyageurs in the mid to late 1600s, all the way up through now. It was full of people were searching for copper, were searching for furs, were searching for anything they could find. Of course, we also had the logging industry. One of the more unique things about living in the Great Lakes itself is that we have a very, very unique culture here in that not only do we have the miners and the loggers, we also have the maritime culture that goes along with it, which makes our Great Lakes history unique in that fashion.
Is that one of the reasons why you decided to write the Piracy on the Great Lakes book?
Well, actually, that started out with State of Michigan asking me to do a lecture for their Upper Peninsula History Conference. They have one here every year for the State of Michigan Historical Society. And in one of my previous books called True Tales, The Forgotten History of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, I talk about a pirate in there that used to sail out of Escanaba. His name was Dan Seavey. And he was really quite well documented. And being who I am, I just am fascinated with pirates. Most people are. And to come across a pirate, I had discovered a folder in Marquette that had a thing called Great Lakes Legends on it, and I opened it up, and there's this pirate. So I ended up following it up. But the Historical Society of Michigan contacted me, asked me if I would do a lecture on Great Lakes pirates and piracy in the Great Lakes region that for a conference lecture, for about 45 minutes. And so when I did the lecture, it was standing room only. I didn't realize there was this much interest in the subject of pirates on the Great Lakes. So I sat down with my publisher and told him, how well it had gone, sent him a copy of the lecture that I had written up for the presentation. And we just decided to expand on it and put it into a book.
Well, I can see that. Why are we so fascinated with pirates? I mean, do you think part of it was just like we were so excited we had pirates that weren't from the Caribbean?
Well, that may be possibly part of it, but also I just think, you know, true crime on most levels at this point is extremely popular.
It is.
You know, we have people that are doing books on serial killers and all sorts of, you know, different types of criminal activities that take place in all of our states. I see books everywhere on, you know, basically true crime. And piracy was one that hadn't really been touched on. It's a subject that few people know about. Almost everybody is surprised when they learn that there were actually pirates sailing in the Great Lakes. And so it ends up being, I think, a discovery for people that really had no idea that anything like that existed.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I grew up in the UP. I went to school on the Garden Peninsula. I had no idea about this, the pirate CV. Never heard a thing about it. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, and he had a place at the Garden. He spent a lot of time there in that area, just like James Strang did south of there in the Beaver Islands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That region seemed to be very, very popular with pirates for some reason. I'm not really sure what it was, but that one seemed to have that area of the Great Lakes seems to have had more than its share of that kind of activity.
Right. Now, when we say pirates, what does a pirate on the Great Lakes look like?
Well, he looks like pretty much everybody else. There was none of this, you know, like fancy dresses that we see, you know, we associate with the Pirates of the Caribbean and things like that. These were just renegade sailors and captains that went out and stole stuff. And they stole pretty much everything that wasn't tied down and some that was. They were all over the place. One of the big reasons is because of the fact that the USS Michigan was the only law on the maritime waters. So wherever the Michigan was, not much was going on, but as soon as they moved into another lake, it opened up everything else. They were patrolling from, you know, they were patrolling Lake Erie, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, and after the Sioux Locks were put in, Lake Superior. And so for that to be the only type of law on the water, piracy was very, very easy to do. You just go pick something off from some dock or raid a ship or whatever, and then go a few ports over and resell it.
Right. I mean, how simple is that, really? You've got one ship on all of the lakes, and so you just need to know where that ship is, and it's open, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is. Absolutely. It wasn't until the latter part of the 19th century, you know, right around 1900, that we really started getting large amounts of interdiction on the water because of eventually bringing in or creating the Coast Guard, which we didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
And once the Coast Guard was created, then it started becoming more difficult, although, admittedly, people like Seavey still, he didn't care. He just went all around the lakes anyway and would just outrace them. So there are quite a few there were quite a few different things going on at the time that eventually put an end to all of it.
Sure.
But,
now, you had mentioned that you had found out about one of the pirates kind of by accident doing some research. I can't believe it was easy to find these pirates that you talk about in your book. What was that research like?
Well, certainly it wasn't easy to find. I've been researching Dan Seavey since the 1980s. So it's been a lot of years of digging into his history and you're right, there isn't a lot of it that's, you know, easy to find out there. That's one of the things about the piracy, of course, is you know you don't want to get caught, so you try to keep it secret. And so a lot of this isn't known, you know, certain activities that were going on. But finding specific individuals is extremely hard. You know, we only have, I think, about half a dozen or so that we really, really know as individual characters that we can look at as, you know, he was the captain, he was leader of the group, that kind of thing. We know there were things, you know, going on like timber pirates would go into places and just steal logs, as many as they could take. They'd steal the lumber and run off with it. And it was a monster problem. The big thing with it is, though, that the settlers and stuff at the time, this was in the 1800s, the settlers at the time hated the trees. They wanted them gone, so they actually were out on the side of the pirates. So consequently, if the pirates were captured or anything like that, some of the locals would rise up and let them loose.
And the reason they wanted the logs gone is because they wanted to farm, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be like that all through, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, all those areas wanted it cleared. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it was certainly started out as, you know, for homesteading and farming and that sort of thing. But of course, it became, you know, communities and things like that. If you look at old photographs, historical photographs, most of the communities you look at back then, there are no trees left.
Yeah, clear cut.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That was one of the things that they, you know, would go after. Of course, you know, with the fur traders, there was fur trade pirates where they would, you know, raid each other's canoes and steal the furs because they were gold.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were worth a heck of a lot of money. The canoes could carry up to, depending on the size of the canoe, some of them were 35 feet long, some of them were 60 feet long and would have, you know, like 15 voyageurs paddling the one canoe, and it would be packed as hard as it could be with furs. And if you, you know, stole a couple of those, you had a lot of money in furs, and there was a war going on between the Northwest Fur Company and Hudson Bay Company over furs and territory and that sort of thing. So they, which even led to a couple of massacres that went on just over the furs, so you could steal from one and sell it to the other.
We are speaking with Michael Klassen. He's author of Piracy on the Great Lakes, True Tales of Freshwater Pirates. Do you have any questions for him? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. At noon today, we're going to hear about the story of Greendale, the planned city near Milwaukee. And then at 12:30, we'll talk with the editor of Lake Superior Magazine. Right now, we are talking about Pirates on the Great Lakes. Michael, why don't you tell me a little bit about what the average ship that sailed the Great Lakes looked like? And we talked a little bit about some of the cargo, furs earlier. Logs. What else? What other kinds of things were they hauling around?
Well, as I said, kind of mentioned earlier, they would take just about any kind of commodity that they could resell somewhere else. It really didn't matter what it was. They would steal cargo from one place to another, just depending on what they got. But it was all about commodities. Most of the earlier pirates, of course, were on sailing ships. Dan Seavey, the pirate that was based in Escanaba, he would preferred schooners. He didn't like motorized ships. He felt they were faster and easier to maneuver, and he could outrun a lot of the steam-powered vessels, and as long as the wind was fair, he was good. And he ended up having, I think, by the time he was done, four or five different ships, but they were all schooners. When James Strang, the Mormon pirate, he had three sailing ships. They would have been three-masted schooners as well. And so they were definitely out there on their sailing. Early on, of course, the fur trade ships, those, as well as the Thousand Islands, Will Johnson, who was that was at the Thousand Islands near New York. He used all the islands as places to hide out and that sort of thing. And they were using sneak up on ships and board them in the night. And then they would go out and escape back into the islands, and nobody could find them. He also claimed to be a privateer working as a Canadian revolutionary against the Canadian government at the time. And so he was able to confuse the legal system enough that they weren't able to prosecute him. They tried to prosecute him on the American side, but because he had written up this document, he himself had written the document that he was commander of the revolutionary forces and that he had every right to be doing what he was doing. And though he really didn't, the Canadians really wanted him. And eventually they would try to go after him, but he would never get caught. He eventually...
Oh, I think we're having... Michael, we're having a lot of problems with your cell phone. Maybe we could reconnect. We'll take a little short break and see if we can maybe reconnect so we don't miss all of your cool information. So let's just take a little bit of break right now. If you've got a question for our Michael, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Hi, this is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau, and tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about biofuels. We're also going to look at a shipwreck that they found in the Fox River, and then we're going to look at centipedes. So please join us. Larry will be back from vacation, so I'm sure he'll be all fresh and willing to talk. Right now, we are looking at piracy on the Great Lakes. We're looking at a book by Michael Klassen. It's called Piracy on the Great Lakes, True Tales of Freshwater Pirates. And Michael, hopefully we got a better connection with you now.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And that's one of the problems of living in the Upper Peninsula.
Our
connections for literally everything are not very good.
I think if someone really wanted to make a lot of money, they would be able to, if they could provide that up there, yeah, they would be a very rich person. So,
yeah, they could do well. There's no doubt of that.
Yes, they could. So, let's start talking about some of the actual pirates themselves. Okay, we had talked about a few, but let's start out with one that's for Wisconsin, the Apostle Islands. Tell us about the little bit that you dug up on that.
Yeah, that was kind of a surprise for me. I came across this story, and it's only, right, as I mentioned in the book, it's only, I've only been able to find one source for this, but it was from the Bayfield, Wisconsin.
Okay, that was even worse. we just dropped you again. I am so sorry. It sounded so good for a while. So you said that you found it from the Bayfield...
Historical Society,
okay.
And it was basically a newspaper clipping about this group of pirates that used to sail out of the Apostle Islands that called themselves the Apostles, and they literally had named themselves Mark, Luke, John, after all of the Apostles. The one who was leading themselves called himself Chief. I don't know. Apparently, he didn't want to be called Jesus
for various reasons.
Yeah, well, they were out raiding the French at the time. This is really early on during the fur days, and they were raiding long rowboats, and they ended up robbing a payroll from the French, which gave them enough incentive to go after them. They eventually got them, hauled them away, hung them all. But supposedly, according to the article I had read, that is because of these apostle pirates. That's where the name of the Apostle Islands comes from. Now, yeah. I'm not sure if that's true, because, like I say, I only found one source for this. But it does make sense. The only other ones that would have done something like that would have been the Jesuits, though they, you know, certainly had a heavy, heavy presence along Lake Superior and that area back in those days.
Sure. It's not like there's just 12 islands. So, I mean, that really does make sense.
Yeah.
Let's go to John in Menominee, Michigan. He's got a comment. Go ahead, John.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate the work that your author is doing, but not every pirate, or I'd say maybe nautical thief, was on ships. There were wreckers in the along the East Coast, and I was just wondering if any of that activity had spread to the Great Lakes.
Oh, yeah, wreckers were actually quite common. It was one of the things that the Mormons really liked to do, from Jesse Strang at the Beaver Island Pirates. He actually was a senator for a while in the state of Michigan, and was able to get lighthouses in at the Beaver Islands. And so then the pirates would use fake lights, shut off the lighthouses, and wreck ships there at the Beaver Islands, and then, of course, steal from the wreckage. But Dan Seavey would also use wrecking tactics, where you put a fake light on a barrel where they were supposed to, you know, put out the light of the real one, and then have them run aground. They were also called moon cussers because of the fact that they did it in the dark of the moon when you couldn't see anything. That way you wouldn't get a glimpse or something of the actual lighthouse or whatever. So they tried to do it on, you know, darker, stormy nights, and then it would make it harder for them to see.
Okay, thank you, John. I really appreciate the call. If you have a question for Michael, give us a call too, 800-642-1234. Now let's dive into James Jesse Strang. Very unusual man. Great beginning. So tell us the tale.
Well, one of the things about Strang is when you read most books about him, they spend most of their time talking about the Mormonism and the Mormon side and him declaring himself King of the Mormons and his split up between Brigham Young and himself after Joseph Smith, the head of the Mormons, died. They ended up splitting off, and James Strang decided to move all of his disciples, basically, to the Beaver Islands, and he claimed to have had a vision from God that all of the islands were the Mormons and that it was their land. And so that also gave them the right to take anything they wanted to off from, quote, their land, you know,
right.
Which it really wasn't. But they would go and they would raid all the little islands and settlements along, like particularly northern Lake Michigan, on both sides, Wisconsin, Michigan, north the lower and upper peninsula. They would raid these places and claim that that was all theirs to start with. And they would take livestock. They would take anything that they wanted to, if they needed equipment. They'd even steal ships, whatever they could come across. So eventually, Strang would start using, he would get away from monogamy and started getting into the polygamy. And he had always claimed not to have, wasn't going to do that. Eventually, he did, which started alienating a lot of his followers, as well as if you weren't going along with the Mormon laws and rules, you could be publicly flogged, which they would take a big birch branch and just whip the crap out of somebody as a punishment for not adhering to the Mormon doctrines that they had established on the islands there. And so consequently, he made a lot of enemies within his own followers and would eventually be assassinated by two of his own followers. There's always been a controversy as whether the USS Michigan was actually involved in that, because they happened to be there at the time when the assassination took place. Strang had become pirates and the Mormonism and raiding the villages and stuff that they wanted him gone. Not just his own people, but everybody who was in the region really wanted him gone. When he was shot, there was a whole bunch of locals that get from like Mackinac Island and Charlevoix and those areas gathered together on a little place called St. Helena Island, which is near where the Mackinac Bridge is now. They got a group together and in one night drove all the Mormons out of the Beaver Islands and just either dropped them off somewhere or would take them to different places to get rid of them. Some of them were beaten. It was a night of terror, considered one of the ugliest evenings in Michigan history.
Wow, that is, you know, that's amazing, and I have never heard of that before, and I don't think a lot of people have. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, I do, particularly about the fact that he was doing the piracy, because, like I said, the things written on him tend to really focus on the Mormonism side and don't talk much about the fact that he also had this pirate fleet that he was out raiding all these different places, and it tends to kind of get lost in the in the biographies, which is kind of sad, because it was a really, in my opinion, a big portion of what he did there. You
know? Right. Now, tell us a little bit about how the Great Lakes came into play during the Civil War.
Yeah, that one was kind of funny. I had to laugh through that. In the Civil War, there was an island in Lake Erie called Johnson's Island. That was a prisoner of war camp for the South, or, you know, it was the North, but I mean, they were housing Southern rebels there. It started out as officers and whatnot from the, captured from the Civil War. And over time, they kept placing more and more people on this island in Lake Erie. So as the Civil War wore on, the South started plotting ideas through Canada of raiding Johnson's Island and releasing all these prisoners into the northern border of the United States and have them, you know, creating havoc and whatnot as they worked their way back to the South. And they were going to hijack the USS Michigan for this purpose. And so they started out doing that, and the hierarchy at the Civil War, Jefferson Davis and his war cabinet, decided not to go through with the first attempt, but the idea stayed out there. And they ended up they got a guy be the crew of the USS Michigan, and he was going to get the USS Michigan drunk or drugged. They weren't really sure which. And then take, you know, basically have a ship come up alongside and take over the USS Michigan. They'd be able to go release all these prisoners. Well, the guy that was on board basically underestimated the crew's ability to drink.
Never do that with a sailor.
Yeah, never do that with a sailor. There's reasons there's songs about that. What do you do with a drunken sailor? But it didn't work. They eventually grabbed him. He was thrown in the brig, the boat, as they were, he was supposed to give a signal to the boat that was supposed to come alongside. And, of course, he never did. So they figured it out and ran. And eventually, they would end up abandoning the boat and the whole plot would go out. But they tried this four different times.
Right.
And were never able to make it work. They have to be the most inept pirates I've ever read about in my entire life.
And you do end that chapter with that particular line. So
I do, yeah. It really is. It's
Now, speaking of the Civil War, there also are rumors about actual lost gold. So there is some of that in the Great Lakes. Why don't you tell us about that one?
Well, one of the things that, you know, tends to follow pirates is treasure. And most of the pirates on the Great Lakes had nothing like that. They were stealing commodities. They weren't stealing gold or things like that. But there were certain plots where they were attempting to bring gold through into the Great Lakes and then down the Illinois into the Mississippi, where they could get around the southern lines and the battles and help resupply with money the soldiers and or the war effort. And supposedly a shipment of that gold came from France and eventually didn't make it. It's one of the larger treasure stories out there, is the treasure of Poverty Island, which is, again, off of the Garden Peninsula, and that the ship that was carrying that gold sunk somewhere around Poverty Island. So treasure hunters have spent years and tons of different expeditions trying to find this supposed lost gold that came from France to help supply the Civil War. Now, it was also said that there was a treasure, strangely enough, on a place called Oak Island, that in the Apostle Islands from the Apostle Pirates that no one has ever found, of course, either. So there are some stories of pirate treasure, but most of them didn't. Like Dan Seavey never would have. He just raided stuff and sold it.
Right.
And that was, you know, and the same thing with Strang. All the stuff that he was raiding, he was bringing back to the community there at Beaver Island. So there really wasn't a treasure involved with that. But there is a lot of stories of when they ran the Mormons out, that the Mormons were run out so fast that they left a lot of things behind, and including money, belongings, all that kind of thing. So there's a possibility you might find a little something on Beaver Island, but it's really hard to say. And there's certainly nothing there that's specific stories about any, like, Mormon treasure or things like that. So,
well, it's always fun to think about it, though.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. Yes. You know, there was a guy who spent his life up at a place called Little Girls Point on Lake Superior. It's right on the Wisconsin, Michigan border. And he had always heard that there was a story of lost treasure there. And he spent his entire life digging holes all around Little Girls Point, looking for some type of Civil War treasure that he had heard was there. And I'm not even sure where he heard it all from, but he never found it. And, you know, that was his entire life, searching for that one little treasure out there. So,
and some of these pits were 80 to 100 feet deep that he was digging.
Yeah. I think he was looking. I think he was looking for more than just a lost box of treasure. When you get that deep, you start to look for more. And certainly, in that area, there, a Little Girl's Point, mm-hmm. is right between a lot of the copper deposits, and with copper comes silver,
sure.
and gold under the same types of processes. So there are times when you can find them all together, but he never found anything.
Mm-hmm.
Out there. So it was just a lifetime of digging holes.
So we talked about the timber that pirates went out of, but how did the was it the Timber Rebellion of 1853 play into that?
Well, that was finally things coming to a head. The USS Michigan and the federal government finally got somebody who was willing to go out there and try and put a stop to all this timber theft on federal lands, which, of course, were much more substantial than they are today. They were trying to put a stop to it, and they finally got a somebody who would do it, but with the aid of the USS Michigan. And when they would try to prosecute the pirates, a lot of the locals weren't willing to go along with it. Those timber pirates were basically their heroes, cleaning out all the timber. And so eventually things got heated enough that one of the ships rammed the USS Michigan, put a good-sized dent in it. But the USS Michigan was also an ironclad. It was the only one on the Great Lakes. And so when the wooden schooner hit the USS Michigan, they didn't sink it. It, you know, caused quite a lot of damage. And for a while, the captain actually thought it was an accident. But over time, they figured out that it was probably just put the mission out of commission. A few days repaired, and it was back out on the water. But eventually, they would start arresting and prosecuting a lot of these timber pirates, and would put an end to it. But it went on. The bigger parts of it were down near southern Lake Michigan, which is where a lot of the activities was taking place, and the rebellion was taking place down there. On both sides of the border, you know, between sure. Wisconsin and Michigan.
Now, one of the pirates that kind of is more prominent during that time is Bully Hayes. What was his life like?
Well, he was an interesting character. He started out in the Great Lakes. He was in Cleveland and started out raiding ships on Lake Erie. And eventually it would become too hot for him there. So he actually sailed to the South Seas and became a South Seas pirate, and a very, very famous one, and to the point where they were even doing pulp fiction novels about him. Pulp fiction was really popular back in around the turn of the century, of course, you know, coming out of the dime novels out of the West. Well, they'd find any type of rip-roaring, snorting type of person that they could write a story about, and Bully Hayes became one of them. And there were, like I say, several comic books, or not comic books, dime novels that featured him. So he rose a lot higher in prominence than an awful lot of the pirates coming out of the Great Lakes, just simply because of his adventures in the South Seas. There was very, very little to locate about him operating here, and when you try to search him out in the South Seas, it's really hard to separate fact from fiction.
Mm. Well, the pirates kind of wanted that, didn't they? They wanted that fear from people.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. They would want that, as well as, of course, you know, these exploits weren't something that they could prosecute them for, because basically they were fiction.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, you would end up letting that go. You know, for the most part, what he did here in Cleveland or whatnot was essentially what everybody else was doing, was just, you know, hit a boat, steal everything that was on it, and then resell it somewhere else on the other end of the lake. And it would go quite well like that. So
now, you've mentioned Dan Seavey a few times. Where he grew up in Maine. How did he get to the Great Lakes?
A lot of people came to the Great Lakes as far as migrating to this area because of work and different things. It was also a place you could go where you could be reasonably anonymous for the most part. I think that's a lot of it. But he originally came, you know, I think moved here through just normal migration, looking to the west and to the frontier like so many did. A lot of people don't realize that this area, Wisconsin, you know, to the Mississippi River and Michigan, were all considered the Northwest Territory. This was the West before the West. And so consequently, it was open country to do pretty much whatever you wanted. You know, there was a lot of illegal things going on. Frequently, the sheriffs and prosecutors, judges, were all involved in illegal activities and that sort of thing. So it wasn't that hard to operate under the radar in these regions, as well as, you know, if you're greasing the right palm, you pretty much wouldn't have much to worry about. So I think that has a lot to do with it as well. A lot of my historic research over the years have really brought home how rugged and ruthless this region really was.
Yeah, and you say, I mean, ruthless, it's, you know, fun to talk about pirates, but a lot of the time they boarded the ships and threw the people that were there off and killed them. So it wasn't like this was a, you know, there was no person who was hurt by this, right?
Well, yeah, except the guys that got thrown overboard.
Yeah.
They, you know, no witnesses are the best witnesses.
Right.
They don't testify in court,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's one of the reasons why I say a lot of our piracy stories are lost because, you know, you don't want people to know about this. You know?
Right, right.
You know, you're committing the worst crimes possible, you know, through murder and mayhem and all this, you know, these other things that go along hand in hand with piracy. So it's it turned out to be, you know, it's they were just as rough and ready as anybody else out there, and certainly without any law on the water, they weren't going to get caught anytime soon. You just, as long as you don't know, as long as the story stays quiet, that's you're good to go.
That's right. We got an email from Chris in Sturgeon Bay. She's wondering if you know of any piracy occurring during Prohibition, and you do have something like that in your book.
I do. Yeah, there was a lot of it. Prohibition was a really ripe time for any kind of thief out there on the water. I came across this character called the Great Ghost, which basically he wore gray and a mask and all this on a boat and ran between Detroit and Windsor and all up and down the Detroit River. A lot of people don't realize it, but there was so much booze being moved across the Detroit River because Canada did not make it illegal. As a matter of fact, they actually encouraged the sales. They would have all sorts of different kinds of booze lined up on the docks for everybody to come over and grab all you want and take it to the U.S. And so consequently, with these runs, if you happen to stop a boat going across, well, they had all this money to buy the booze with. If you caught them when you were coming back from over there, they would have a cargo load of booze that you could resell. So consequently, if you were pirating these guys, which they were, they were easy marks. They're either carrying cash or commodities, and you know, people don't realize, but in 1 year, just across the section of the Detroit River, between Lake Huron and Lake Erie, just in that little bit, there was $212 million worth of booze moved across in the 1930s in 1 year.
Yeah, fortunes were made, weren't they? And what are you going to do? You can't complain to the authorities because what you're doing is illegal. So
right,
mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's free and open and pretty much lawless.
Right.
And again, you know, at least, you know, during Prohibition, there were there was police on the water and things like that that were trying to catch this, but, you know, it was really, really tough. When I did the gray ghost thing, the one of the most difficult things to deal with that was there was more than one of them. There was one that was in Detroit, there was one on the East Coast, and there was one on the West Coast, all called the gray ghost. So sorting that out was interesting because, of course, you know, those in many of the articles and stuff, they were getting mixed up.
Sure.
So,
yeah, I was just flabbergasted that he painted his guns, his pistols gray. He dressed in gray, like a gray trench coat. And this is like right out of the movies.
It is. I know. When I found the character, I'm just laughing because I'm thinking, oh, God, this really is. Yeah, it's like something out of a 1930s pulp novel.
Totally. You know? It certainly is. It certainly is. So how did who or what put an end to the pirates on the Great Lakes?
Mostly the law. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we still have, things coming across the Great Lakes. And it's, you know, people still smuggle things and whatnot. It's not like what it was in the old days. But, you still occasionally have people doing stuff like that. But mostly the end of Prohibition kind of put an end to all of it. It, there was the mobs moved into things like heroin and opium and, you know, stuff like that once the booze became legal again, and which was not a commodity that was coming through the Great Lakes. That would be something that was going to be shipped in, you know, through the West Coast or the East Coast or, you know, that sort of thing. So we don't really see as much of it as we did then. And the Great Lakes kind of at this point, because we're so isolated here between Canada and the U.S., that you don't see much of that coming across the Canadian border anymore. But certainly you do see it coming across the waters, the oceans and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, in my opinion, Prohibition pretty much was the end of the piracy within the Great Lakes itself.
Sure. I guess that makes sense. Now, you've written a number of books and articles about the UP. Do you have something that you're working on right now?
Yeah, I have several things I'm working on. I'm, I have a book that did really well called True Tales, The Forgotten History of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and I'm just finishing off a second one of UP history. And so instead of like trying to write a history of the UP, I've just picked up little bits and pieces here and there, just some of the wilder and crazier stories that are up here. There used to be women's stockades that were up here that were prisons for women that were kidnapped off from farms in Wisconsin, Ohio, Illinois. And they were brought up here and tortured into being prostitutes for loggers and stuff like that in these isolated places all through the wilderness and woods up here. And they were called stockades. And they were all over the place from Minnesota all the way to the eastern UP and lower Michigan. So,
wow. That's definitely something that is not out there readily. So,
no, it actually surprised a lot of the communities that I was doing this with, too. So,
yeah, for sure. Well, we want to thank you, Michael, for being with us today. When that next book comes out, let us know, and maybe we can have you back to talk about that, too.
Well, that sounds good.
All right.
Always happy to do these kinds of things, and thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. We've been talking with Michael Klassen. He's the author of Piracy on the Great Lakes, True Tales of Freshwater Pirates. Stay with us because we're going to talk about Greendale. It's a planned city. Have you heard of planned cities? Well, stick with us and you'll learn all about it. Thank you. Thanks for spending some of your time with us today on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Larry's back tomorrow. We're going to start this hour by talking about the unique history of the city of Greendale. And in case you didn't know, it's located just southwest of Milwaukee. We have a couple of experts on Greendale with us. Ted Manila is the treasurer and past president of the Greendale Historical Society. And with him is Mary Manila. She's the manager of the house on Apple Court. It's a renovated short-term rental owned by the Greendale Historical Society. Now, have you been to Greendale? What do you think? Do you think that Planned City should be revived? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call. 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mary, Ted, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Yes. Thanks for inviting us.
You bet. Well, we had a listener say, hey, when we had an open mic, that you should talk about Greendale. And I said, well, that's a great idea. So here we are. Now, you both were born and raised in Greendale, right?
Correct. We were.
And Ted, I believe that you have a story to tell about you and Mary. Ted, are you there?
Yes, I'm there. You just cut out just a little bit, so hopefully we're back with you.
Oh, hopefully. We're having problems with that today, but I believe that you and Mary went to school together.
Well, yes, we did. We were both born in Greendale and lived here with our parents, of course, in the Greendale original. But then we also both went to Greendale High School, which is where we first met. We went out together in high school for a little bit and then later in college, and we've been happily married for 57 years.
Well, that's amazing. you had mentioned that a Greendale original. Why don't you explain what that is, Mary?
Well, an original are one of the homes that were designed.
Okay.
1936 is when they began, and that's what we have all as part of our entire community museum, we call it, because these originals reflect the National Historic Landmark we are, and they are very unique. I like the fact that you used that word before. We are totally unique. But the homes, there's about 572 units within the original part of Greendale, and that's why we call the homes original.
I noticed that on some of the things I was looking at, that there was this the originals. And at first, I'm like, what are they talking about? But that makes sense, because you have more than just the buildings that were built at that time right now, right?
That's right, yeah. It's a larger community, of course. But
of course. Now, back in 2012, Greendale was named a National Historic Landmark. Are there lots of cities that get that designation, or is that kind of rare, Ted?
Actually, it's rather rare. The Village of Greendale, through one of our members, Kathleen Hart, started working on a campaign along with another our president at the time, Sally Chadwick, in applying for National Historic Landmark designation. So it's a rather arduous process. It's issued by the United States Government Department of Interior. And after going through that process over a couple of years, Greendale was designated that. So it's really one of the rare instances where an entire community, rather than a single artifact or a single object, is recognized with that designation. So we're very pleased and very proud of that designation.
And what does that designation do for the city itself?
Well, again, I hope you can still hear me. The designation, above all, gives the community a chance to really explain that designation to visitors, and that, you know, they realize that the significance of the community is unique in all of the United States. So the wording says it's a significant in American history. And as a historical society, you know, we think that's very important. We work very hard as an organization to not only preserve our buildings, but to share the Greendale story with people just like we're doing today.
Well, let's share that story. Let's get down to the facts now. Mary, Greendale is one of three Greenbelt communities that were built during the Great Depression. What did FDR hope to achieve by creating these green towns?
I'm sorry, because it was cut off. I didn't quite hear that question.
Okay.
What are the other two towns? Is that what you wish to hear?
No, I was just wondering, what was Franklin Roosevelt trying to achieve by creating the Green Towns program?
Well, I mean, he was trying to demonstrate a new type of living that would use farmland outside of major industrial cities. He also wanted to provide work for the men, many of them, still out of work, laborers, construction workers, particularly because they just weren't building during the Depression. So it provided, you know, that opportunity. And it also was for the shortage of housing for the people that did have jobs in the city. I mean, because we had places like Ellis Chalmers and so forth, there were they couldn't build a home. And the house, apparently Milwaukee was really overcrowded and even had tenement type housing and things like that. It was kind of bad at the time. So they wanted new homes for them, affordable for them to rent. And, you know, the idea of having kind of the country atmosphere as well.
I mean, we're kind of in that situation today, aren't we, where affordable housing is very difficult to find. Has anybody, like, come to Greendale and said, now, how did this work? Can we maybe duplicate it at this point?
Well, Ted, have there been some people of that sort that you're aware of?
Yeah, that's a great question. Greendale often shows up in scholarly studies, architectural studies. And I'll just give you an example of the design of Greendale. It's considered very pedestrian friendly. There are very few through streets. Speed limits don't exceed 25 miles an hour. Most of the homes are on streets that are cul-de-sacs. This contributes not only to a much safer environment, but it's also ringed by a green belt of land to prevent encroachment from other areas. And, you know, people have come to us, contacted the Historical Society. In fact, a group from Alabama is coming to visit in October for that very reason, because they're community shares many of those design elements. So,
Now, we had talked a little bit, Mary, about why Greendale was chosen as one of the cities in the Green Towns program, and there were two others in the country, right? Where were they?
They were Green Hills, Ohio, which is right outside of Cincinnati, and Greenbelt, Maryland, which is right outside of Washington, D.C.
And how many acres of land did the government buy? And who did they buy it from?
That's a question. I know that it's probably something my husband might know the actual numbers. I want to say it was like, you know, 34,000, but that sounds kind of crazy. But they did buy it from the farmers that were surrounding this area, many who were perhaps, you know, living as farmers do, eat from, you know, what's on their own land, but they weren't willing to sell it. So I think the price that the government offered must have been tempting, and that's what happened, as far as we're aware.
Ted, do you know how many acres?
I think it was, I think my wife had an extra zero to it, but it was about 3,000 acres.
How much was it?
There's a great story involved in that, the acquisition of farmland. You know, Greendale was all farmland in 1935 when the government started looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great book written by Arnie Allenon, who's a professor emeritus at UW-Madison, called Main Street Ready Made. And the Greendale Historical Society now is the publisher of that book called Main Street Ready Made. And it goes through and it chronicles all that. And just to answer your question specifically about the land, the federal government, being mindful of the fact that they wanted to use taxpayer dollars responsibly, came in and started to buy up farms one by one. There were a lot of small farms, so it wasn't just one big 1,000-acre farm. There were several 20-acre farms. And over a period of time, the government came into Greendale, which was to become Greendale, and started buying up that farm property piece by piece. And in the Main Street Ready Made book, Professor Allen and details a story where one stubborn holdout refused to sell to the government until he got his price.
So did people know that this was going on, or was it kind of a secret thing?
It was kind of a secret, but after a while, at least that stubborn farmer caught on and negotiated a better price than some of his fellow farmers did.
So, okay. So why don't you give us the kind of the layout and design of Greendale? It's basically a Garden City concept, right? What's that?
Sure, exactly. Greendale, you know, presently is bordered roughly on the north by West Edgerton, on the south by College Avenue, on the east by 51st Street, and by the on the west by 76th Street, by 92nd Street. So it's still a small community.
Mm-hmm.
But the original community, as Mary said, there were only 572 living spaces, so the population was around 3,000 before it expanded. But what we call, as Mary mentioned, the originals are these unique styled, often two-story homes of about 1,100 square feet each that were designed for families with children.
And what were the requirements in order to, you were renting a home now from the government, right? You didn't own these homes at the time. What were the requirements, Mary? Do you know those?
Well, I do know that there was quite a process that you had to go through. But one of the biggest things was your income. You could not have too little and you could not have too much. So that was a very important factor because they wanted, you know, the people that really needed this kind of housing to qualify. Also, a big factor was the number of children you had. So there were these homes, but you couldn't say, oh, I want to rent this one or I want to rent that one. They looked at the number of kids you had and assigned you a home that had the appropriate bedrooms and so forth. And there was, you know, a consideration about your character and that sort of thing that they, you know,
they were
a little bit fussy from what we understand, but and some people thought it was a little bit, you know, socialistic or communistic, apparently. But ultimately, it all did work out. And I think the majority of the people did have occupations on the south side and some of the major, as I said before, industrial companies. And that's what helped them get these jobs. I know that's when my father, that's what happened. He was working at Allen Bradley and other men that lived in Greendale told him about Greendale, and then, you know, they applied to live here and pay $19 a month for rent. You know.
Yes. Very unlike today. And let's talk about the city center, Ted. How important was that for this community?
Well, that's a great question because all of Greendale was designed, and it carries that over today, that we're one of the few communities in the surrounding area, suburbs of Milwaukee, that have a central downtown. And when the designers developed the outline for Greendale, they wanted to make it self-contained. So originally, Greendale had a movie theater. It had a library, the school. It had a drugstore, it had a grocery store, and one of the, they surveyed people, you know, so the government didn't just decide to build this. They surveyed folks and said, well, if we're going to build a town, what else do you need in that town? Well, they needed all those things that I just mentioned, But this is Milwaukee, right? So they, one of the things that was high on the list, they have to have a tavern.
So of
they
course.
Built a tavern in the center of Greendale called the, it was called the Greendale Village Inn. And it actually still stands today under different names. It's Joey Girard's now, but it is on the National Register of Historic Places, and it's part of the national landmark as having survived since 1938. So Greendale today continues to be a vibrant town. There are several shops, stores, areas where people can shop, go out for lunch, go out for dinner. It's a very vibrant town, and we have a welcome center that the Historical Society works with in the village of Greendale. People can come to the center of Greendale and stop in the welcome center and learn all about the opportunities that they have to spend some time here.
And if you do decide to spend some time, you can also stay at the Apple Courthouse, which is so unusual because the Historical Society actually owns it. Mary, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, the home itself was chosen by us, or allowed, I guess we were allowed to purchase it, but partly because it had not been altered. Two rather reclusive women had lived there since 1952 when they purchased it and had not made any major changes. So this was so exciting. The county at first thought that they would restore this and flip it. And ultimately, we got the chance to buy it, and we did all the heavy work that was required, along with many professionals like plumbers and electricians and so forth, and then attempted to make it look as it did in 1938. We were fortunate to have photos from the model home that Eleanor Roosevelt went through in Greendale, and so we kind of tried to duplicate that as best we could, and fortunately even had some furniture that was donated to us by persons who had lived in the early days of Greendale. And that beautiful amber maple furniture was made by the craftsmen that in Washington, D.C., actually. And they shipped it out to people that wanted to purchase that furniture. And so now we have some original furniture in our original home, and it looks like 1938. Won't look like something you ever saw.
Right. It really does. Now, you rent it out as a short-term rental, and you can see pictures of it. I believe you do VRBO and Airbnb, right?
That's correct, yes.
Does it book out pretty often?
It does. Primarily weekends, you know, people coming in for special events. But this summer, it's been very busy, and, you know, because I have to be there, even though we have, you know, cleaning service and all this stuff, I'm, you know, over there quite a bit, just, you know, making sure everything's going okay.
Yeah.
And everybody's happy.
And this is all volunteer, and all the profits go to the Historical Society. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Wonderful. Yes. I love that. It's a huge undertaking, but it sounds like you have a very active Historical Society. Would you say that, Ted?
Yeah, we're really very fortunate. In fact, we're celebrating, the Historical Society is celebrating its 50th anniversary as an organization this year. So we began in 1975, and we list about 300 members, and we've done a number of projects. You know, Mary was just talking about the house on Apple Court. But in addition to that, the Greendale Historical Society worked together with the community and raised $600,000 to restore one of its iconic buildings that we refer to as the Hose Tower. And that's also available. The Village of Greendale owns it, but it's available for parties and rentals and weddings. And it's a really a neat venue right in the heart of Greendale. And we also have an antique fire engine called the Diamond T. And All of this is member supported. So we don't have any paid staff. We don't get funding from any other entity.
That's wonderful.
We're an independent group with a real vibrant membership.
Well, I think we have time just for one short comment from Jim in Stevens Point. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, good morning. So I grew up in Greendale. My parents moved there in the late 1950s. My dad worked at Cutler Hammer Corporation, and I believe that they bought a home show model home, and it was located right behind the high school on a farm field. And as a kid, it was just a great place to grow up because you could get everywhere on your bike. There were trails. There were sidewalks. It was just a wonderful place to live. Since then, I've come back to Stevens Point with my daughters to visit grandparents when they lived there. And I was just there for my class 50th class reunion and hung around downtown. And it's great to see how it's always changing, yet it always kind of stays the same. It was just a great place to grow up.
Well, thank you, Jim. That's a really good way to kind of end our conversation.
You.
I mean, that was basically the whole point, wasn't it? That it would be a great place to live and grow up.
Absolutely.
So, Ted, tell me, if someone wants to learn more about Greendale, what's their first step?
Well, the first step would be if you're want to be on the internet and check that out, you can go to GreendaleHistoricalSociety.org, which is our website, and that'll give you all sorts of links to what's going on in Greendale. You can link to the village's website as well. We have a 24/7 phone number. I can give that out, which is 414-421-1938. So it's the year 1938, and it's 421. So people want to call there and give us a message, or they can email us at greendalereply@gmail.com. If they want to come to Greendale, stop in at the Welcome Center. We'd be glad to give you a tour and guide you through the options of Greendale.
And you mentioned a book that also explains some of that background.
Yeah, the book is, we have two books that we publish. The first one is Main Street Ready Made, and the other is Greendale Remembers, which is an oral history of Greendale. Both of these are published by the Society. You can find them on our website or by calling that number.
Okay, sounds great. Well, Ted and Mary Minilla, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Alice, thank you for inviting us.
You bet. Ted and Mary are both involved with the Greendale's Historical Society. Coming up next, we're going to talk about Lake Superior Magazine with editor Connie LeMay. If you have any questions about Lake Superior, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lake Superior is the coldest and deepest of our Great Lakes, so if you're looking to cool off this summer, you might want to head north. There are plenty of lake towns to explore and festivals to attend. I'm Jill Nadeau, this is the Larry Mueller Show, and we are going to be talking about Lake Superior Magazine. They publish stories from the communities around Lake Superior, lots of gorgeous photos, and we have the magazine's editor with us, Connie LeMay. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for joining us today. And if you want to ask her a question, maybe you love living on Lake Superior, you have a boat or like to sail on Lake Superior, give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Connie, I have to admit that I did not know this magazine existed until you all sent us one.
Wow, good for us.
Yeah.
I
was like, where have you been all my life? When did the magazine start?
It actually started in 1979, and it was started by a photographer and a businesswoman who loved the area. And so they start up the magazine, which is probably why the magazine has always had a reputation for excellent photography.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very blessed with extremely generous photographers from our area who are just incredibly good and also understand that we're a regional publication and work with us and what we can afford to pay them. And but the images are always fantastic.
So they are.
I'm always proud of the issues for that.
And I'm looking at the July issue right now. It's in my hands. But I'm looking at the cover with a sailing ship with actual sails on it. But the water, they got the water so perfect that you know it's freezing cold.
Well, and that's all kind of relative, you know, here in Duluth. I grew up in Duluth, and we often swim in the lake. It's, if it's shallow enough, it can get warm. But you're right. Once you hit that deep water, you know it.
It's cold. Yeah, I grew up in Lake Michigan side of the UP. So, yeah, that's definitely a lot colder than Lake Michigan is. So, yeah, it was like we were always told if you go up there, you can't even wade in it because your feet will go numb. So.
Oh, they were joking you.
Wrong. So, you know, let's talk about all these boats that you have in this issue. How much interest do you take in boats yourself?
You know, I have to admit, and I think I mentioned it in that issue, that my mom was afraid of the water. And so I didn't even learn to swim properly, to be honest with you, until I was an adult. Being a nanny in the Mediterranean area.
You notice
to go in the water.
The water's much warmer there.
Yes, it is. And it's also salt water, so
yes.
You float much better. So I love boats, especially the big boats. And I've been on the Lake Superior Marine Museum Association board a number of times. And so I do love all things nautical. But if you've got nautical questions for me, I have to defer them to somebody who actually knows what they're talking about.
Well, nautical life is a really big part of the communities around Lake Superior, isn't it?
You know, maritime, kind of like the lake itself, again, like I said, growing up here in Duluth, I never realized how much Lake Superior was my focused horizon until I moved away to college. And then suddenly there wasn't that big, beautiful water all over on the horizon. And it's the same with the maritime. I grew up just assuming everybody was seeing sailboats and ore freighters and ocean-going vessels pulling up to your shoreline right in the middle of the United States.
So there is a new book, or another edition of a pretty, it must be popular book that you wrote an article about, Bonnie Dahl's Lake Superior Way. Now, she's an expert, obviously,
in
navigating.
She definitely is an expert and from Wisconsin. And Bonnie did what is called lovingly the Bible of Lake Superior sailing, which is Superior Way. And this is her fifth edition of that book. There's not another one like it on any of the other Great Lakes. And Bonnie and her husband were both teachers, and they spent the entire summers basically on Lake Superior, going in and out and around all of the small anchorages and the little especially the wilderness anchorages. And there just is nothing else like having people who have been there to tell you all the things you need to know.
Yeah, so valuable. We have a call. Scott in Iron River has a question for you. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I was just compelled to call. My wife and I live in Iron River, Wisconsin, which is in Bayfield County, just about 15 miles from the lake. I have some friends coming up, and we are going on a guided sunset paddle tonight. I'm just really looking forward to it. It'll be my first time doing that off of Myers Beach to the Sea Caves. Just wondering, any comments on that, what we should be looking for? My friends who have never paddled on the big lake, and I've never paddled myself out there. And also maybe to comment on the winter time conditions. It's been a lot of years since we've been able to walk out there in the winter. So that's my question. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you,
Thanks.
Scott.
And Scott, you will soon know much more than I do. Again, also have not paddled on Lake Superior, although I've been on some cruises. I will say that. Myers Beach especially, gorgeous and beautiful area, part of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore on the mainland side. And I think what Scott was referring to are the sea caves, because the Apostle Islands are noted for sea caves on the mainland and then also on the islands, especially Devil's Island, which has just these spectacular caves carved out by the lake waters. So on Myers Beach, they'll find some really good paddling, I'm sure, along the lakeshore. And there, it's a highly popular space with kayakers. I should probably mention just in passing, too, as a little bit of, by way of a plug, Lake Superior Magazine does an achievement award every year for groups and individuals that have significantly contributed to the well-being of the lake and the peoples of the lake. And the Friends of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore is one of the groups that we have honored in the past. And in part, that's because they work really hard to make that lakeshore accessible to people with physical sorts of needs, but also just to local kids and stuff who may not have the wherewithal to get out on the water, like Scott's talking about. So getting the local children more familiar with their lakeshore, even if they don't have a sailboat and even if they haven't learned to kayak. So I just have to give them a plug at the same time.
Yeah,
and it
cool.
is true. It's been a long time since you've been able to walk off the mainland from Myers Beach over to the what are then called ice caves in the winter. I think it was back maybe even almost 10-plus years ago now when there was a really good, solid freezing. And people from around the world came to see the ice caves, and it was suddenly exceedingly popular. And for those tiny little areas, like around Cornucopia, it got incredibly busy for a while. And I remember the National Park Service calling for volunteers to help them direct traffic and such.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that was about 10 years or so ago. It was like everybody had to go and see these sea caves. So ice caves, I should say. Ice in the sea caves is what
there
we're talking about. Well, thanks, Scott, and have fun out there. Don't forget your personal flotation device.
That's what I was going to say. Be safe.
Yes,
definitely.
Absolutely. Now, you have other things in here besides talking about sailing and whatnot. You had an article about a fish, and it's called the coaster brook trout. Now, for those who don't know it, why don't you describe this fish and why people are so excited about what's happening to it?
Well, a brook trout, people are familiar with, and this is in that family, but these are brook trout that have decided they want to live on a bigger water, and so they come down the streams into Lake Superior and then make Lake Superior their home, basically. And it's rare that, or at least it's been rare, that there has been a spawning population in Lake Superior, and the Minnesota DNR recently discovered some coasters that are spawning around the Minnesota shore, and so that has been very exciting for people. In Red Cliff, I believe, the band of Lake Superior Chippewa there have been hoping to stalk coasters around the Bayfield area as well. And I believe there is also a spawning population up at Isle Royal.
And this, I read that because of the coldness of the lake, that it is easier for the trout to survive and flourish because they don't have the temperature variations as much. Is that right?
Especially as we progress in our current conditions, yeah, the lake in some ways can be more consistent, especially if fish can go deep. I'll tell you also a little known side fact about one of my favorite trout in Lake Superior. There's also lake trout, of course,
uh-huh.
And there is a kind of lake trout called a fatty lake trout or siskowet, which also is well known around Isle Royal. And a few years ago I read, and I'm hoping this is a true fact, if you want to say that, but I had read that there was that these siskowet deep water fatty lake trout, 5% of their diet, can you guess what it is?
No, tell me.
Songbirds.
Really?
Oh, and God. That is because Lake Superior is a migration flyway. And sadly, not all of the little birds make it all the way across. And apparently the trout take advantage of that.
Oh, my gosh. So do they actually jump out of the water and grab these little birds?
No, I think sadly the birds just don't make it all the way over, and so they're in the water when the fish are looking for food. I took a tour to a cruise to Isle Royale one time from you can take it both from the Minnesota shore and from the Keweenaw Peninsula, and I do remember some tiny little sparrow birds landing on the ferry and just looking exhausted and being very happy there was a ferry they could take a break on.
I'll bet. Well, we're talking with Connie LeMay. She is the editor of Lake Superior Magazine. If you have a question or a comment about life along Lake Superior, give us a call. 800-642-1234. If you want, you can send an email. It's talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Larry's back tomorrow, and we're going to talk about biofuels and then a shipwreck that was just discovered in the Fox River. And then we'll wrap things up with a look at centipedes. That's tomorrow starting at 11 right here. Right now, we are talking about the Great Lakes and the wonderful magazine that's called Lake Superior. And tell me, Bonnie... Connie. I'm sorry. I was looking at
That's
Bonnie.
Okay.
It's Connie with a K.
Yes.
I bet you say that a lot. Anyway, tell us how people can get this magazine.
Oh, well, the magazine is available. We only do a print edition, so you're not able to access it online only. So we do have a website for the magazine, lakesuperior.com, pretty simple. Through there, you can get our weekly e-newsletter that we call Around the Circle This Week. And that is, I call it lovingly, the Huffington Post of Lake Superior. It's kind of a roundup of all four shores. Yeah, because the magazine and the newsletter cover the lake's four shores, Ontario, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan. But if you want to order the magazine, go to lakesuperiormagazine.com. That's our retail website, and that has subscriptions to the magazine. We have a whole retail branch, so we have a number of gift items related to Lake Superior or produced around Lake Superior, and other items that people might like a Lake Superior wall calendar.
Ah, with all your beautiful pictures in it.
That's right. Not mine, but somebody's wonderful looking pictures. Hey, I have a quick question for you though, Jill.
Yeah.
You grew up, you said, by Lake Michigan. Have you been to Lake Superior? Do you have a favorite spot?
Oh, God. You know, 2 weekends ago, I was up in Munising. Because it's not too far from where I grew up. Just go up Highway 13, and there it is. And I took the boat out for the first time in like 20 years. I enjoyed myself so much. It was beautiful. The weather was a little on the cool side and had rained, but all of the beautiful cliffs and things were just gorgeous. So that's my favorite spot.
Pictured Rocks, National Lakeshore. I believe that Lake Superior, well, there were only four national lakeshores. Two of them are on Lake Superior, and then one recently became a park. And so there are only, I think, three left, and two of them are here on our lake.
Isn't that great? Yeah, it's just magnificent. And I always think it's funny when people who are not from the area come up and say, this isn't a lake, it's way too big. and it really is. So, you know, but you know, it looks wonderful, but it can be a little scary sometimes. Michael DeWitt wrote a really nice piece about a storm on the lake that he went through a couple of years ago. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, Michael, by the way, is one of those magnificent photographers who we work with quite a bit. And his home area is the Apostles. And so he was talking about a storm that came up fairly suddenly. And that is what happens with Lake Superior. The people who sail know to be very careful about what the conditions are looking like. And so Michael always is. But in this case, they ended up going out to the islands and getting caught on it. And he ended up trying to maneuver his motorboat, powerboat, into a better position, and ended up not having power and just riding the storm, basically. Oof. And so he did a story about that called "The Lake Is Boss." And he's a, besides being a great photographer, he's an excellent storyteller. And so this is his story. It's Lake Superior Journal. We have at least one first person experience around the lake in the magazine. And so that's what that okay. one is. It's Lake Superior Journal.
Okay. And of course, we Lake Superior has water, but there's also so many good trails for hiking or ATV and biking. Why don't you tell us some of the ones that are in Wisconsin, the recreational trails?
Yeah, we have kind of a roundup story this issue on You've Got Trail, it's called, and we talk about some of the trails people can go on around the lake, both hiking and biking. And among the major ones in what we would call the extended Lake Superior neighborhood, of course, are the trails taken care of by the Shequamigan Bike Organization. But there's also the Lakeshore Trail that's along the mainland unit of the Apostles. And this, again, is by the Myers Beach and the Sea Caves. That trail is a little, especially as you go further along the shore, it is a little more challenging. And so you kind of have to watch for those sorts of things. But then even Bayfield has the Brownstone Trail within it, which is a nice trail a little bit inland. And then there's just some wonderful areas around the lake and around the region. Relatively new to the lake is the Frog Bay National Park, Tribal Park.
Oh,
and that was created by the Red Cliff Band, and that has a loop, a trail loop that goes along the lake and then inland a little way.
How are the black flies and other flying insects up there this year?
You know, so far, at least in the Duluth neighborhood, it hasn't been too bad. And weirdly, mosquitoes haven't been too bad. And I think that's because it's been a bit dry on some shores.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not true all over. In fact, we've had flash flooding around some regions of our area. But here in Duluth, we haven't been as wet as we would normally like.
Okay. Well, if you don't like mosquitoes, then head for that side of the
there
lake.
There you go.
Right?
Speaking of ships and shipwrecks, though, I should probably make sure people know that this is the 50th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And so there will be a number of commemorative things happening both here around the lake, but also around the Great Lakes to honor those 29 crew members who perished in that 1975 wreck. And in our October-November issue, we'll be talking about many things connected to the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Although it kind of depresses me because I was in high school when that went ahead. So if it was 50 years ago.
Me and me.
Like, dang, where'd the time go, right?
That's
another great place to visit is the Shipwreck Museum up in Whitefish Point, right? Whitefish Point.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. An excellent place to go. And then Duluth has a Maritime Visitor Center that has some good exhibits right by the aerial lift bridge. So mm-hmm. for maritime places to visit, those are two good places, although we have great heritage sites all around the lake.
Yes. And speaking of Duluth, you kind of closed up the magazine with a little story on Uncle Harvey's mausoleum, which I thought was pretty interesting. Tell us about that.
Well, there is a concrete structure half just kind of lying off the shoreline of Duluth. And it's shaped somewhat like a boat hull. And so people often say, "What is that thing?" and it was created as a place. I believe they were going to do sand and gravel, and the idea was that the boats would come in, they'd unload there. And then it would be easier than coming into the harbor area and cheaper, I'm assuming, is what they also thought would be happening. But the thing about being exposed to Lake Superior is that you are exposed to Lake Superior.
Yes.
So that structure was built in 1919, and I think it had to close by 1922, in part because of the continual damage that the lake was doing to it. And the structure's still there, which does say something about it, because there are a number of things that have actually physically been moved by the lake. So it is still there, and I wouldn't recommend it, but I do know that some young folk here from Duluth occasionally will use it as a diving platform.
Oh, I can see that. But you really need to know what you're doing and what's under the water there.
Yes, and be very aware of whether we are at high tide, so to speak, or low tide,
yeah.
Whether you're having a fish or not.
Right. Now, speaking of which, you have a information in the magazine about lake levels. Why do you publish that?
Oh, you know, partly it is tradition because having the magazine start in 79, there weren't quite as many online opportunities,
none
basically, for some of this information. So a lot of this you can get updated quite quickly. And this particular chart that we use is from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And it shows the lake levels, and people are curious about it, every issue, especially people who have been following the lake and what's happening on the lake for years, to see if the lake levels are up or down and what kind of trends we're having.
And there is kind of an ebb and flow. Is it like every 10 years the lakes get really high and then they go really low and then they come back, right?
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know if it's quite cyclical as much as you think. It does happen with some regularity, but yes, there's definitely that ebb and flow of the lake. And one of my favorite quotes was by someone with the Port Authority here many years ago, who has since passed, but he said that the maritime industry always got blamed when we have high levels on Lake Superior, because they said they flooded it specifically so the boats could be, have better position. And he said, but nobody calls to thank us when there's a low lake level.
It's amazing, isn't it, how that works?
That is right.
Well, Connie, we have had such a great conversation with you, and hopefully we can have you back again and talk about the next issue with us. That would be great.
Oh, that'd be delightful. Thank you so much for the invitation.
You're welcome, and keep us on your list of sending magazines out, okay?
We will. I'll put you on there.
Wonderful. We've been talking with Connie LeMay. She's the editor of Lake Superior Magazine. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about biofuels and a shipwreck and also centipedes, if you're into centipedes. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you to our crew, Claire Neipert, Joel Patenaud, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, and, of course, Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thank you for joining us today. Have a great one.